Welcome to our new podcast series, Accessing Justice, which is hosted by CommuniCourt. During this series, we are going to be talking to a number of guests about how fair access to justice really is for people with communication difficulties. We're really excited and grateful to welcome Dr. Katie Maras, Senior Lecturer at the Centre for Applied Autism Research at the University of Bath. Dr. Maras's area of research is how autistic adults think and communicate differently, and what adaptations might need to be made by services to accommodate these differences. Her particular area of interest is how autistic people cope when they're interviewed by the police as a witness or suspect of an alleged offence. Her research shows that current police interviewing techniques do not elicit the best evidence from autistic people, and that interviewers need to adapt their questioning styles in order to obtain detailed, relevant, and accurate information about an event. Dr. Maras, welcome to Accessing Justice, and thank you so much for finding the time to talk to us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. I wanted to start by introducing your research, really. It's covered a number of areas, from police questioning to how autistic people fare in job interviews. How did you become involved in this area of research?
Initially, I was quite interested in the kind of theoretical underpinnings of it. I was very interested in memory and cognition in terms of eyewitness testimony more broadly. And it was just kind of one of those things. I just sort of stumbled upon it, to be honest. I was talking to different heads of departments about areas I could do a PhD in. And Dermot Bowler, who was the head of the autism research group at City University, said, well, I don't know anything about eyewitness testimony, but I do know a lot about memory in autism, and autistic people have these specific memory difficulties. It'd be really interesting to see how they would fare sort of criminal justice system setting. So that was basically how I got started into it. And then it's just gone on from there. It's got, you know, I said, really interesting theoretical implications, but obviously practical implications as well. And so it's just grown from there.
So did you have any experience of autism at all before you started your research?
I didn't, no. My PhD was my first kind of foray into the autism world.
So now you've started your research, what kind of communication problems are experienced by autistic people?
Well, it's obviously the language difficulties. So a lot of the research that I do focuses on the more intellectually able autistic people. And so they have less obviously apparent communication difficulties. But of course, you can get very good kind of expressive language that can mask some difficulties in receptive language. And I think that's particularly problematic, actually, for some people, because it's then their vulnerabilities are not, or that the issues that they need support with are not picked up. So there's this kind of mismatch often between expressive and receptive language. Very kind of literal interpretation can be problematic for, you know, understanding questions like I'm just going to jog your memory, draw your own conclusions, or questions that are posed as statements, you know, that it's not obvious that they need to be answered. So I think these sorts of things kind of crop up quite a lot in police interviews or criminal justice system interviews, that then mean someone's not putting forward the best answer that's really answering the question, because they didn't realise it was, you know, meant in that way. And this kind of links to, you know, social cognition, theory of mind, recognising how much they need to report, what sort of information they need to report. So it's that gauging the interviewer's intent. So all these things sort of feed into communication, don't they? So, you know, it's not language, just language specifically, but it's these other issues as well. Executive functioning as well. So, you know, that's related to language processing. But also, if there's lots going on in an interview, you know, you're trying to remember the interviewer's question, you're trying to figure out what exactly they mean by their question, you're trying to remember an event which might have happened a long time ago, you're trying to pull together a coherent narrative. You know, there's a lot of executive demands that are going on there, and if that's already sort of strained in autism, or they're using compensatory strategies for things like memory, that they might reconstruct a memory in a slightly different way, then that's going to be particularly problematic in this sort of scenario as well. And then we've got indirect issues as well, like around anxiety, environmental stressors and things like this as well, that's just going to make all of that, you know, a lot more challenging.
So you were talking about expressive and receptive language. Could you explain a bit about what that means?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. So expressive language is a person's ability to to articulate, basically, to speak, to say things, to get their point across. Whereas receptive language is more of an understanding of what is being said. So you might get somebody who's very, who comes across to be very articulate, and then the listener will immediately associate that person with then having good receptive or good understanding of what's being said back. But that's not always the case.
In this particular situation where somebody's been interviewed by the police, what are the challenges that are going to be unique to autistic people?
I think one of the main things, certainly from the perspective that I come at this with my research, is memory difficulties. So there's, other groups like people with intellectual disability who might have a kind of broader memory difficulties, whereas the memory difficulties in autism, at least once you've taken any kind of intellectual difficulty out of the equation, tend to be very specific episodic memory difficulties. So this is remembering a past personally experienced event that's situated, in a particular time, in a particular place, as opposed to remembering facts or things that have happened over an extended period of time, which tends to be fine. It's this recalling specific instances that's problematic for autistic people. So that's obviously what you're normally trying to get at in a investigative interview, is a specific instance. So that's kind of an area where I think it's not specific just to autism, but this tends to be more common in autism. And then we've got things like, theory of mind or social cognition. So understanding or recognizing the interviewer's intention behind their questions, sensory issues as well. Again, not unique to autistic people, but tend to be more common in autistic people, which, if you're being interviewed in a police station, it might be loud and horrible acoustics, strip lighting or whatever. And then I guess the expressive and receptive language thing as well tends to be a bit more common in autism.
We are looking at how people with a wide range of communication issues access justice when they're the defendant. And your research really looks at the first stage of this process when they're being questioned by the police. Can you tell us about what your research project found?
Yeah, so all of the research really has been focused more on the witness side of things. So we haven't really got any specific research looking at defendants or suspects at this time, although there's obvious differences, but there's obvious overlapping similarities between the two, and some of the principles remain. But ultimately, the research shown that gold standard police interviewing techniques, such as the use of very free recall, very open questions, are quite problematic for autistic people, due to some of these things that I've already mentioned, like understanding how much to report or getting that kind of implicit gauge of how much would be appropriate to report, trying to kind of filter out everything that would be irrelevant, what would be relevant, and trying to remember it, and then trying to produce a coherent narrative about it all. So we tend to find that autistic people don't do so well under these free recall, what we call free recall, was very, this very open, tell me everything that happened without any prompts. And of course, the specific episodic memory difficulties as well. And one of the main findings from my PhD supervisor's research, actually, back in the 90s and early 2000s, Dermot Bowler, is he coined the source support or task support hypothesis for memory in autism. And this is that although free recall, autistic people find it very difficult to recall episodic memories under free recall, if you give them more support, so just asking more cued questions, then they can actually report as much, which is a really important finding because it suggests that the memory difficulties are related to retrieval rather than encoding. So the memory is there, we just need to tailor what we do. And so my research has looked at this in a more kind of applied context, in terms of recalling eyewitness memories. So that's kind of was quite a large body of work for a few years, where it was sort of these are all the things that don't work, and it's asking very open-ended questions. And then more recently, we've been testing out techniques that do actually work. So we can't just ask questions, although we know that they will recall more memories that way. That's not obviously not appropriate within a legal framework. And we know that autistic people, they're not any more suggestible than non-autistic people, but they may be more compliant. They may be more likely to go along with suggestions. So although prompting does produce more specific episodic instances, examples of what they've done, we were trying to figure out how can we get a more supportive interview that is still appropriate within a legal framework. So we developed, we called the WAFA, the witness aimed first account interview technique, whereby the witness basically segments their memory of what happened up into very small chunks, and the interviewer will write the chunks on a post-it notes and display them on the wall or whatever next to them. So rather than going in and being like, right, tell me absolutely everything, don't leave anything out, which is the normal way to start an interview, it's a kind of break the event into these chunks in just a sentence or a few words, and then you visit each of those chunks in as much detail as possible in turn. So you're kind of reducing these demands on executive functions. So you don't have to hold lots of information in mind because you're just focusing on that segment. You're alleviating the kind of social cognition requirements. You know, it's clear then what it is they need to report. This is the bit you're focusing on. And it just kind of makes it easier for a witness to generate their memory and account of what happened. So that's kind of one of the more useful techniques that's come out of all of this. And also preparation as well. So just providing a witness, and this would certainly apply to suspects as well, information before they get to the interview. You know, where is it going to be? What sort of questions are they going to be asked? And so it's not sort of sprung on them, and they get time to prepare. That reduces their anxiety. They're more prepared to be able to then really search their memory and give a good account of what happened.
And what has the response been? I mean, is this recognised as an issue by police? Is this something that people have been very happy to get involved in the research? What's happened as a result of it?
It really varies by force. Some forces are super keen on all of this and want to know, you know, all of the findings as they emerge. Others are, oh, there's a problem in autism, and they're very, you know, don't have any autism training. So it really does vary. But generally, it's been really, really positive. And as I said, I spent a lot of years talking to police and saying, these techniques don't work. And they're sort of, well, what does work then? And for ages, I'm like, well, we don't know yet. So it's really nice now to actually be able to say, you know, these techniques do work. And as well as the WAFA interview, there's some other findings as well around sketching that Michelle Matteson has done. So it's nice to be able to talk to them about these things that they can do that are positive. And that's been received really well.
So have they been rolled out in particular areas in the country?
Avon and Somerset are doing, I work quite closely with them, and then some other forces as well. It depends on, even within a force, I think it can be quite segmented in terms of what techniques they're using.
And what about in the legal profession? Has any of your research looked at how autistic people fare when they're in a courtroom?
We've done a little bit of work around that. We've done work from the perspective of people's experiences. So rather than the very controlled sort of experimental work that is sort of most of my research takes that more that approach, we've looked at actually people's experiences. How did they find it? What were their perceptions of it? And we did kind of papers in parallel, ones with people's experiences of police interactions and ones with their experiences when they go through the courtroom. And they both had similar findings, really, that largely autistic people weren't very satisfied with the support that they received, mainly feeling this kind of lack of understanding on the part of legal professionals for their specific needs. So that's looking at the experiences. My PhD student, Ralph Bagnall, is currently looking at suspect interviewing experimentally and lived experiences as well. So that's some really exciting research that should be coming out in the next year or two. And we've done a bit of work as well around others' perceptions of autistic people. So how are they perceived by others when you kind of describe like very typical autistic behaviour in court, and what the impact of giving the mock jurors information about that person, about their diagnosis and about how their autism affects them. And we found that knowing that somebody's autistic and having a bit of information about how it affects them significantly improves their perceptions of that person, like really significantly improves it, to the extent where they might even say this person's not guilty, whereas before they would have said he was guilty. It becomes like an explanation for these behaviours that might otherwise be attributed to being perhaps not very trustworthy. But actually, once they know they have autism, they go, oh, okay, it's the autism. That's why they're, you know, not making eye contact in court or whatever.
And these challenges aren't unique to the police and courts, of course. So have you been looking at any other areas where autistic people struggle because of communication issues?
Yeah, we've been looking at this in relation to health and social care interviews and job interviews as well. Similar principles, you know, you've got to normally recall something that's happened in your past. You've got to take account of the questioner's intent and what sort of information they're looking for. So we've adapted standard job interview questions and looked at how that impacts somebody's ability to sort of sell themselves basically in a job interview. And we found that breaking questions down, being explicit about the parameters, similar to the WOFA interview basically, really boosts their ability to provide a good response during job interviews. So for example, rather than saying, tell me a bit about yourself, which is my, you know, how a job interview might start, they, I'm going to ask you to give me a short introduction to yourself. What are your best personal characteristics? What are your educational qualifications? What work experience do you have? So, you know, there's no ambiguity then, you know, tell me a bit about yourself, you know, what's your favorite food, for example, might come out of that. It's not clear exactly what it is. You've got to read it within the context. So breaking it down and being very explicit is really effective.
So what do you think are some of the main issues or the main characteristics, the main behaviours that autistic people might display, which causes this breakdown between what they mean and what other people perceive and understand?
It can be, for example, a very literal interpretation of the questions. They give a response that might seem like they're being insolent, or, you know, do you know where do you live in a house? That's a, you know, very literal answer. But, you know, if you're doing that to a police officer that you've just been arrested, they might think, well, they're just, you know. So there's that. There's sometimes a lack of or atypical eye contact. So not making eye contact with the interviewer or looking around where it wouldn't necessarily be, you know, a non-autistic person wouldn't look around in that way. Maybe fidgeting or stimming, so having kind of some kind of repetitive finger movement, for example, not displaying what would be considered an appropriate level of emotion for the gravity of an event that they're talking about. So smiling when they're reporting something really sad, but not actually reflective of how they're feeling, but that's just how it's communicated. So those are the sorts of things that can be quite misleading for a perceiver when they're trying to, and of course in that situation the perceiver, be it an investigative officer or a jury member, is trying to gauge how truthful that person is and how credible they are, and these can all be, you know, kind of red herrings basically.
Have you come across intermediaries in your work?
Yes, and I think it's an area we really need some more research on. There's been very limited research so far with intermediaries, and I think it's really important to do some more on this and also try and get a good measure of effectiveness, because experimentally we tend to quantify recall in things like the number of correct details, for example. And I think we need some more research in this area, looking at kind of the different ways that intermediaries facilitate communication, because intermediaries are undeniably helpful for sure, and it would be nice to be able to document that in a more sort of formal way in research, and definitely at court as well, not only at the police interview and at court, and also for defendants, of course. You know, we've got the registered intermediaries for victims, witnesses, but to have registered intermediaries or something more formalised for suspects and defendants, and have an evidence base to sort of support that would be great.
So this area of research, we talked earlier about how you'd got into it, but what inspires you?
I really like the sort of geeky aspect of it. I like the theory and getting the kind of, you know, the evidence side of it, but also the practical motivation. You know, it's so important, and, you know, this is people's real lives that it impacts. And so being able to generate new evidence, and also useful techniques that's actually going to be helpful both for practitioners and for, you know, the individuals going through the criminal justice system is incredibly motivating.
Fantastic. So sort of looking forward for your hopes for your research in the future, and more generally just what's needed in this area. What do you think are some of the main things that we need to look at to improve access to justice for people with communication problems?
Court, I think, is a massive area that's not been really hardly looked at all. A lot of the work has been around police interviews. It's easier to conduct the research in that way. It's harder to do it, I think. But, you know, cross-examination is a different kettle of fish altogether. And I think we really, really need some more research around cross-examination. As I said, we need a lot of more research around intermediaries as well, and also appropriate adults. I think we need to look at more as well about you know, these adaptations to interview techniques, and for different groups as well, so not just intellectually able autistic people, for other people with other communication difficulties that aren't autistic, but also autistic people that are less able to express themselves in this way, so they'll, you know, they will need specific techniques as well. I think more research as well as around the actual environment that they're in, because it obviously has an indirect impact on one's ability to be able to concentrate and relax and produce their best evidence. We need some more research as well, I think, around training. We need a more joined up approach for legal professionals, police and other legal professionals, that's role specific, not just this is what autism is. It's actually, you know, this is your toolkit that you can use with an autistic person. But, you know, it's very flexible and it depends on the individual. And to have that kind of flexible approach to interviewing, I think, is really important. And I think we need some more work as well around recognition of autism or communication difficulties more broadly, and facilitating diagnosis disclosure is important, because a lot of autistic people are reluctant to disclose their diagnosis because they fear that they'll be stigmatized against, or you know, at best they just won't receive the support that they need, whereas actually that's important in order to trigger, you know, the support. But also, as I mentioned, it's really good for perceptions as well. We've done work in both the defendant and the witness sides and show that in both cases diagnosis disclosure really helps, but possibly you need some information about autism to go along with that, to kind of educate people. So I think they're kind of, from my perspective, some of the main areas for further research, and definitely on suspects, defendants as well.
Thank you so much to Katie for giving up some of her time to talk to us. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please let us know on Twitter or LinkedIn. You can find out more about the series and Accessing Justice by visiting www.communicourt.co.uk. Thank you for listening.